Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thanks for joining this this last International Inequalities Seminar of the term, of the Michaelmas term here at LSE. I'm delighted that we have Gordon Anderson with us today. My name is Chico Ferreira, and I'm your chair today. So Gordon is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Toronto. He's held various appointments at Southampton University, McMaster University, the University of Toronto, he's visiting professor at British Columbia, the Australian National University, the University of Western Australia. He's won various prizes, including the Bowley Prize, the Sayers Prize, the University of London, and the Journal of Applied Econometrics Distinguished Author Award. And is an old friend, and I'm delighted to have Gordon with us today. He'll be speaking about, is there a grand gender convergence in 21st century Canada? The jury is still out. Now, just before I hand over the floor to Gordon, there are a couple of logistical things, just very quickly. So this is a Zoom meeting rather than a webinar. So ideally, you'd keep your camera on, but you'd keep muted, and you'll get a chance to ask questions at the end, which we'll do just by speaking. You don't need to type anything, just ask the question. And I do want to say that the upcoming event, the last event of the year here for us, will be an exciting one, launch of the book, The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future of Work by Jan Eickhout. And that'll be on Thursday at 5:30 p.m. in London. So without further ado, we have an hour. I think Gordon will speak for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll have some time for questions at the end. Thanks very much, Gordon. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Chico. I really appreciate the invite. This, believe it or not, is the first time I've given a seminar at the London School of Economics, having graduated from there in 1972, I think it was. It's taken sort of 50 years to get an invite back. What can I say? Anyway, so what I want to talk about today is the grand gender convergence in Canada, and essentially whether or not one exists. Equal pay for equal work has been a mantra of female emancipation movements for at least 150 years. Back in the 1860s, Susan Anthony coined the phrase of equal pay for equal work, and it was carried on by Carrie Ashton, who was arguing for female emancipation essentially at the ballot box, which she argued would then give them a source to equal pay for equal work. And this has been followed by Claudia Goldin, who in 2014, I think it was, published a paper recording essentially the progress that women were making in sort of earnings parity, if you want to call it that. And she was concerned that whilst there had been considerable progress, it seemed to have stalled. It seemed to have, the convergence of earnings, male-female earnings convergence, seemed to have slowed down. And she felt that the problem was in the sort of middle or higher income groups, where essentially this was professional agencies, where people were disproportionately rewarded for sort of long sustained periods of work at inconvenient hours. And she felt that this disadvantaged women and wanted to see some sort of restructuring in remuneration to record that effect. And she classified the stalled convergence of earnings, she classified the convergence of earnings as the grand gender convergence, and was concerned that the process essentially had stalled. And I got interested in this for several reasons, but mainly I was doing some work on Canadian incomes, income distributions. Canadian provincial income distributions for males and females. And it occurred to me that perhaps the convergence in earnings or incomes wasn't the whole story with equal pay for equal work, that there is another side to this issue, if you like, that Claudia had sort of ignored, that you just don't have to look at earnings alone. There has to be some other things that are coming together, if you like. So what's the sort of underlying premise that I'm working with? Well, equal pay for equal work demands similarity in rewards for similar efforts used with similar human resource stocks between the genders. So if you think about income as the reward for the effort applied to one's human resources in the workplace in order to produce, if there's no wage discrimination and a presumption that the genders are equally willing to work, and that sort of willingness to work is similarly distributed across the genders, then similar human resource stock distributions should engender similar income distributions. That's the basic concern that I had. So you've really got to be looking for increased similarity in human resources at the same time as you've got increased similarities in incomes or earnings. What this implies statistically is that if you've got increased complete similarity in all these dimensions, then gender designation becomes immaterial. That is to say, males and females will become perfect substitutes in the labor force. That's the idea. And they are in some sense exchangeable, perfectly exchangeable. When I heard that, that rung a bell with me statistically. That has to do with what we think of as exchangeable distributions. So when two distributions are exchangeable, it means that a random draw from one of those distributions is equivalent to a random draw from the other distribution. So for all intents and purposes, the distributions are identical. So what that implies for the present concern is that the joint distributions of incomes, human resources, and efforts should be identical across the three distributions. That's the sort of basic idea, if you like. If they're not, even if you have similar effort distributions, if there are differences in rewards, you can still get similar income distributions if you use different stocks of human resources. So the point is this: common or similar income distributions is a necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition for grand gender convergence. Grand gender convergence demands convergence in the distribution in all of its dimensions. That's the concern, and that's what the objective, if you like, of the work here. So it then occurred to me that this really has a sort of an equal opportunity interpretation, where you've got the gender is in some sense the circumstance that shouldn't influence the equality of male and female outcome distributions. And so what we require, if you like, is that the income or earnings distributions should be similar or exchangeable for male and female groups with similar effort and human resource levels. So you're looking for this similarity across the spectrum of effort and human resource levels. Now, in terms of That's a sort of long run equilibrium, equality of opportunity situation. But Sen and Atkinson both argued that that's never going to happen. It's unlikely that you would ever measure complete similarity between these two gender-based distributions. But what the policy process should be, or what the objective of policy should be, is the promotion of progress to similar distributions, which is essentially the promotion of convergence towards the equal opportunity state. So the focus of our analysis, the focus of our work, is whether or not these various distributions in their various guises are actually converging to one another. That's the essence of the story that I want to tell here. And I think I'm going to skip this slide. I'll just put it up for now, but this is essentially formally writing down what we're going to need. And what you'll observe is, if you've got convergence, so if you've got a common earnings function, so in equilibrium, if there is gender equality, then males and females would enjoy the same earnings function. And that will induce, that particular common earnings function will induce similarities in the income, human resource, and effort distributions. In particular, from my perspective, what I'm looking for is similarity in the earnings or income and human resource distribution for given common effort levels. And that's in essence what we're looking at in equilibrium. Now, if the equilibrium is a stable equilibrium in the labor market, then you should find that when the distributions don't cohere, when they're different, there is a determinant process which will cause convergence to the equilibrium equality of the two distributions. And I learned that from Harold and Hahn back in 1971 when I was a student at the LSE. So essentially what that means, though, is that all marginal and conditional distributions for boys and girls or males and females will similarly converge to a common distribution. So it's not just the overall distributions that converge, but their marginal and conditional representations have to converge as well. And so that's what statistically I'll be looking for in the results. And in order to establish a grand gender convergence in the sense that Golding means it, is to require convergence in all of these distributions, convergence between the male and female distributions, not just subsets of them. Here's the problem that we've got in this particular analysis. It's the challenge of measuring what human resources are. Here, what we think of as human resources is a sort of complex combination of a person's received education and training, which I'm going to call that their embodied human capital, and their accumulated experiences, which I'll think of in terms of people's ages. So an individual's human resource stock is essentially assumed to be an increasing, possibly concave function of their embodied human capital and their accumulated experience. The problem is that these are really latent constructs. We don't observe the levels of human capital or the actual cardinal measures of human capital or accumulated experience at all. All we have are ordered categorical variants, which allow us to sort of imagine what they might be. And furthermore, with sort of two distinct factors, that is the embodied human capital and the accumulated experience, they've got to be aggregated in some way. Now, people have approached this issue by artificially cardinalizing these categories. And that's run into all sorts of problems. There's a strong critique of this practice in Schoeder and in Yazaki and Bond and Lang, which demonstrate that the problem with arbitrarily cardinalizing ordinal categories is the scaling problem. That is, all the measures that we might use are inherently scale dependent, and the scales are quite arbitrary. So what we've been doing is to work with ways of ranking and ordering characteristics that are essentially ordinal categories into some sort of cardinal measure, if you like, that we can use. And we've developed an extension of some work that I did with Terry Post and YJ Wang, where we developed some what we called utopia dystopia indices for portfolios. Those are continuously measured, but we needed some sort of index of portfolio values that would work in these sorts of contexts. And what we've done here, or what I've done here, is to extend that sort of analysis to ordinal variables rather than to... So we're not confined to ordinal variables, and we're not confined to univariate variables. We're going to do these sorts of things with multidimensional ordinal variants. That's the point. And I'm going to convert these multidimensional ordinal variants into some sort of cardinal measure or cardinal index in order to perform the analysis. So what we'll be doing is to measure the level of human resources at a particular income quintile and measure the income levels, relative income levels, at a given human resource group designation. And we'll make the comparisons in those sorts of contexts. These ideas are based upon work that Nick Gravel did, that's appeared in the Economic Theory Journal, and some work that myself and a student of mine, Leo Tenghua, where we are essentially producing scale-independent dominance orderings based upon these indices that we've developed for groups where all the variables are ordered categorical. So we don't actually have cardinal measures for them, but we succeed in generating some cardinal measures for these techniques. So what's the idea? Well, basically, we're going to construct an upper frontier of the cumulative distribution, or the cumulants of the cumulative distribution, and a lower frontier. These are essentially envelopes of a collection of distributions. And we're going to then develop an index, which is essentially the sum of the differences between the upper frontier and a particular distribution, and divide that by the difference between the upper frontier and the lower frontier summed, integrated across those agencies. And that's going to provide us with a unit interval normalized index that tells you how far above, if you like, from the lowest possible distribution is a given distribution. So it tells you how much benefit there is to being in a particular group relative to being in the worst endowed group. Think about it that way. we can do this trick, excuse me, for both resources, human resources, and for income quintiles, which is what we'll be doing in the analysis. So once we've got these data, what we want to do is essentially to measure some distributional differences and use measures of convergence. So to do this, we're going to use, for the measures of convergence, we're going to use Gini's transvariation, which is essentially the sort of accumulated differences of probability distribution functions over the range of the variable. And what we know is that that's equal to one minus the overlap of those two distributions. And it gives us a very nice 0-1 measure of the extent of difference between two distributions. And it turns out that it has a very nice sort of asymptotic distribution, which is easy to use. We developed that with, I developed that with Oliver Linton and YJ Wang. And basically the idea is this: if the transvariation at period t is greater than the transvariation at period t plus k for some categories, then we have convergence over the k periods, because inherently the two distributions are closer together. So our measure is going to be the change in the transvariation, if you like. Now, obviously, we're looking at across a group of categories, so we're thinking about simultaneous convergence across a collection of categories or groups. And the way we can look at that is to sum the differences in the transvariations. So essentially, we're looking for them to all be commonly positive for convergence in that case. And if they're all negative, then we have divergence. Now, if that's uniformly the case across all categories, then we have what we call universal convergence or divergence. And we can test that using Stolen and Urey maximum modulus distributions. That's quite straightforward to do. Finally, as a simple check on this universality, if we look at the absolute sum of the differences and divide that by the sum of the absolute differences, then if that's close to one, that means we have universality in convergence. It's a very convenient method for establishing universal convergence in a group, a collection of groups. So onto the data book for Canada. What do we have? We've got data on incomes, ages, genders, and educational status and provenance of residents for individuals in Canada, as drawn from the Canadian census. And I've got these data for 2001, 2006, 2011, 2016. This is all agents over the age of 19 who received income and reported their status were included. That's, as you can imagine, thousands of observations. And what we used as an income variable was membership of an income quintile. So essentially, I worked out the aggregate income quintiles, and membership of an income quintile was my income variate for males or females. The six education categories which dictated our human capital, embodied human capital, were no certificate or diploma. And then the second category, well, you can read them, secondary, high school diploma, trade, and so on, up through to a master's and doctorate. And the age groups I'm looking at were 20 to 29 year olds, 30 to 39 year olds. So they're essentially six age groups, and there are six ordered educational categories. So these are my basic source data. To get a picture of what's going on here, I think is the best way of looking at stochastic dominance. I've got the cumulative density function male-female ratios across the vintiles. Now, if male and female distributions are identical, these should all record the value one. When the values are systematically below one, it means that males' income distribution stochastically dominates female income distribution. If they were above one across the whole set of vintiles, it means that females stochastically dominate males' income distributions. Now, if you're looking at the picture, you'll see that we have stochastic dominance of males over females' income distributions in 2001 and 2006, because they're always strictly below one, except for the 20th vintile. And then when you look at 2011, you see that at the lowest vintile, the ratio is greater than one. So that means that there is no stochastic dominance. But there is a term these days that's used that's due to Leshnow and Levy called almost stochastic dominance, where if the stochastic dominance rule is marginally broken, you can claim almost dominance. So what we can say here is that the male income distribution almost dominates the female income distribution. But in 2016, there is no recorded dominance at all, because there is a preponderance of males in the lower income brackets in 2016 relative to females. What you can also see is that the income distributions over the years are getting closer to the value one across the board. What that's telling me is there is income convergence. So what that's telling me is there's a good chance that visually what we're seeing here is some considerable income convergence in male-female income distributions. Although this is a not direct measure, but it is a pictorial image, if you like. Well, let's have a look at the sort of basic statistics. These are the transvariations. And what you can see here is that the male and female overall income transvariation, so this is across all cohorts, human capital cohorts, the transvariations are diminishing over the years. They start off at 0.228 and they end up at 0.177. There's a slight increase from 2011 to 2016, but these are significant reductions in the transvariation, which is strong evidence of convergence. And if you look at the average transvariations across all human resource statuses, they are significantly converging. So yes, it is true. We do have what I'll call income convergence or earnings convergence between males and females in Canada. But does that necessarily mean we've got a grand gender convergence? Well, let's move on and see. I did actually do an analysis of the overlaps here, which is of interest. I think I'm going to skip that because of the shortage of time. Let's look at the stochastic dominance relationships for the female education and age ordered categorical cumulative distributions. Here we get a very different story. So when we look at education, we see that there is no dominance established at all. But what you do see in the education itself is there is a tendency towards dominance of females over males in Canada. So that means that females are tending to have a stochastically dominant distribution of human capital, embodied human capital. Indeed, if you did a second order analysis here, you'd find that in 2016, females have embodied human capital distribution, which stochastically dominates the male embodied human capital distribution. What does that mean? That means that generally speaking, females are bringing to the workplace a better stock of embodied human capital than males are on average in Canada in 2016. Now, when we look at the age distributions, which I'm going to use as a proxy for experience, it's well known that females have a better life prospect than males in terms of length of life. And so it's no surprise to see that in terms of experience, females' age distributions stochastically dominate males' age distributions over the period. There's no clear convergence here, but in every category, females have a lower, except the last, females have a lower probability of being in that category than males do, which means they have a better life expectancy, basically. So what about the human resource stocks and the grand gender convergence? So you recall from the beginning, our premise is that for a grand gender convergence, we need both convergence in incomes, which we've established, and we need convergence in human resource stocks. But it seems here that we've got a problem because the human resource stocks appear to be diverging. what you find if you look at the transvariations of the human resource stocks, this is a bivariate distribution. And if you use our transvariations, bivariate transvariations, what you observe is the male-female differences are increasing systematically over time and significantly so. So it appears that we've got divergence in human resources. And we can sort of confirm that by looking at something which is somewhat more familiar. That's the coefficient of variation, but these are distributional coefficients of variation. So you know the coefficient of variation usually looks at the standard deviation of a variable divided by its mean. Well, this is like the distributional coefficient of variation is like the difference between a distribution and in a collection and the average distribution in that collection averaged. So it's sort of a distributional coefficient of variation, if you like. And what do we see there? We see that the education distributions are diverging, the age distributions are converging. Overall, so the joint distribution appears to be diverging. So the education component of that joint distribution seems to be generating that overall divergence. I've looked at this for all of the categories and you get similar results there. So there's clear evidence of divergence. So what about these stochastic dominance comparisons formally? How do we go about using these? Well, we're going to use the cumulative density functions and the cumulates of the cumulative density functions. These are ordered categorical data, so they don't use any scaling to achieve this. These are just sort of sums of sums, if you like, to get these cumulative and these cumulative density functions and cumulative density functions. So if our human resource distribution, which is a function of an ordered categorical human capital level and an ordered categorical experience level, then for first order dominance, we need the joint distribution of girls, females, to be everywhere below the joint distribution of males with strict inequality somewhere. And if you think that the human resource function is monotonic, non-decreasing, and concave, then you need the same sort of pattern in the cumulative density functions, which I've specified in that top line. And these conditions may be examined by looking at the differences and the cumulative differences in indices. And so these are the indices I'm interested in, which is essentially the sums of the differences. And then I'm going to look at the sums of the differences divided by the sums of the absolute differences. What we need is for the sums of the differences to be positive and for this ratio to be equal to one, and that will establish for us first order or second order dominance, depending upon what you're working with. But I found this is a very convenient way of establishing dominance without doing too many sort of complicated statistical inference procedures. So you're just going to look for positivity of the sum and its proximity of the sum and the ratio of the absolute value differences being equal to one, and that will establish dominance in the appropriate class for us. So what do we get when we do that sort of trick? Well, what we get is kind of what we saw in the picture. In the first order case, the cumulative differences of the cumulative density functions are always positive, but their ratio comparator is not equal to one. So we can't establish first order dominance of females over males. When we look at the second order, though, indeed we can. So we find that the cumulative differences are always positive, and the test, if you like, the ratio test, as I call it, is always equal to one. So we do have strong second order dominance of human resources of females over males. Interestingly, also, this gap, if you like, this is the sums of the differences, is growing over time. So this is strong evidence that not only do females have better human resources than males, but the gap is growing in Canada, which is, these are, I should stress, females and males in the labor force. So these are females and males who are working and enjoying incomes. And that's essentially the dialogue I've just explained to you. So when we look at the absolute rank differences, this is just for some friends of mine who work with ranks of things, if you look at rank differences, you'll see in terms of income distributions, males always rank outdistance females, but the rank differences are diminishing. But in terms of human resources, females always outrank males, and the differences are increasing. So essentially, we've got a story here of convergence in incomes between males and females, but actually divergence in human resources between males and females, with females having superior human resources. And that's Canada's story. So quickly draw some conclusions. If you think of a world of equal opportunity unconstrained by circumstance of gender, then we hope to see commonality in both income and human resource distributions between the genders in income. And if there is not commonality, we hope to see convergence of both types of distribution. When I've looked at these possibilities in terms of Canada in the 21st century, whilst the income distributions are clearly moving together, their human resource distributions are clearly moving apart, with females better placed than males in the workplace. So what's really going on in Canada? It seems that females are achieving the same sorts of levels of income as males by using a better quality of human resources. So there is still sort of gender discrimination, if you like, in the workforce, in that it seems that females have to bring a better stock of human capital to the human resources to the workplace in order to achieve the same level of incomes. So this is not a characteristic of grand gender convergence in Canada, I have to say. And therein I'll stop and wait for comments.
Thank you very much, Gordon. That was really interesting. I have a few questions, but I see that Paulo has one. So let's start with Paulo, please.
Hi, Paulo.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Thanks for the great presentation, Gordon. So I have a question about your first, very first figure, in which there was this astonishing jump in 2016 that was suggesting convergence. No?
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly what you have shown us, this convergence is taking place mainly at the bottom of the distribution. My question is looking at this, my first reaction was this may has to do with immigrants or other part of the population that is changing very rapidly and that is bringing something new. So I think you didn't show anything about the area of birth or the immigration status. No. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I didn't.
Thanks. These data do include immigrant status workers, as long as they are permanent residents. So, for example, I live in a wine region, and there is a huge increase in the labor force around this time of the year, or a bit earlier. Largely, it's immigrants from Mexico and South America who come up for the wine, the grape picking season, essentially. They don't appear in my data because they're just temporary workers. So the only people that are in my data are immigrants who have resident status, if you like. Well, what I think that huge disparity in male over female incomes is it is true that immigrants, males, tend to find work at the lower end of the income spectrum on immigration. So you have families of immigrants, and it's the man who tends to go to work first. And so what I think is that, and there was an influx in sort of 2014-15 of these families. And I think it's in part that. It's also the fact that there was quite a recession in Canada in, I guess it was about 2009, 2010, which was felt in the ensuing years. And that tended to affect males more than females. So, you know, it was males who lost their jobs and then struggled to get back into the workforce. So I think that bulge that you see for 2016, which is what I think you're referring to, is down to that. It was an influx of immigrants, and that was predominantly a disproportionate number of males entering the workforce at the lower end of the income spectrum, and also the problems that were residual to the recession that we had. But I have not done an analysis of that. That's my, conjecture.
Okay, so we have a question from Alessio Rebecchi from Griffith University. Okay, so he asks, how can this approach be extended in the EOP framework, the Equality of Opportunity framework, considering more circumstances at the same time? Now, Gordon, if I may, let me ask you one of my questions. I had three. Yeah. One of them is related to this question. He's saying it's late in Australia. So it is the Griffith University, which I thought it was, which is in Queensland. And I've actually been there, which is amazing, since I haven't been in that many places in Australia. But so my question is this. You related this to the inequality of opportunity paradigm. And I was thinking that when we normally look for convergence, following Rome or other people typically say, okay, there's an advantage variable, in this case, earnings on the labor market. And if you got those two distributions converging towards the same cumulative distribution function, then you're moving towards equality of opportunity. Now that follows in a sense from this identification assumption where we take the rank in that distribution, so the quantile of the distribution as a measure of relative effort. You were doing something else. You were saying, I actually observe effort. I'm going to call the circumstance here, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to interpret your, the circumstance here is gender. And then there is, human capital, but human capital, maybe it's an effort, maybe, women are becoming more educated. So if you're thinking of it as an effort, there may be also effort in the labor market. Then you're saying, well, I'm not going to take the rank in the distribution of incomes as a measure of effort. I have a measure of effort already. And so I actually require that the joint distribution is converging. All of the distributions are converging. That's what you said in the beginning. The conditionals, the joint, the marginals, everything has to converge. That's much stricter than we normally do. And it is much stricter because you are, I think, Paolo may also have views on this, but I think it's because you are sort of suspending or relaxing this identification assumption Romer makes, which is to say the rank in the distribution of the advantage variable is your measure of effort. So that's related in some sense to, I think, Alessio's question. Maybe you want to take both of those.
Yeah, sure. Actually, what I do in essence is to fudge the effort issue. So I start off at the beginning by saying, we're going to assume that effort distributions, which are fundamentally unobservable. We assume that they are identically distributed across the genders. So what am I saying? I'm saying that males and females have exactly the same distributions of proclivity for effort. Okay, then if you like, I've assumed that part away. And so now all I'm seeking is convergence of income distributions at every human resource level and convergence of human resource distributions at every income level. So I don't think I'm using human resources as a proxy for effort, which is, I think, what you were thinking I was doing.
But neither are you using it as a circumstance, right? So in this very simple world that we live in, the equality of opportunity literature, things are either a circumstance, an effort, or an advantage.
Yeah.
Or luck. But you know, luck depends, complicated. Anyway, so I think you're thinking of it as an outcome as well, as an advantage. You're saying there's more than one advantage. And I want them to converge in human resources as well as in incomes, because those are all advantages. Is that how you're thinking of it?
Sort of, but I think rather I'm thinking that these effort distributions have already converged. So I'm working on the assumption that given males and females have identical effort distributions, then what are we looking for? We're now looking for convergence in the circumstances and the outcomes.
I see. Well, we could.
Can I jump in, Chiho and Gordon? Sorry. So while I was listening to your presentation, my understanding of what you are proposing is that you are basically adding an efficiency concern. So the idea that from an inequality opportunity point of view, I don't care what is your level of education, as far as you are in the same position in the outcome distribution and you get the same outcome, there is no violation of the principle. And it's like, if here there is something more, which is, look, I also want the outcome to depend on the human resources and the only reason why you want this is, as Chiho was suggesting, because you consider it an outcome, and so you want also the distribution of education to fulfill the requirement of equal opportunity, or because you have an efficiency idea not explicitly presented, maybe here, but maybe in the paper. And I think it's something that is very interesting in the sense that I think there is always a lot of implicit thinking about efficiency when discussing the idea of equality of opportunity, which is not as explicit as you are doing here. So that were what I thought while I was listening to you and then to your question, Chico. I don't know what you think.
Actually, it's interesting you say that, because I'm doing some work sort of unrelated to this on efficiency issues. And there what I'm interested in is there's two types of inequality, seems to me, if you're looking at inequality in a well-being sense. There is what I would call undesirable inequalities, but there are also desirable inequalities. So if we think of income as being the reward for producing the social product, we would like to reward people who produce more social product more than people who produce less social product. And those types of disparities cannot be unwelcome if everybody in society agrees that if you're producing more social product than I am, you should get more reward. Then everybody in the society will be accepting of that. And that's essentially an efficiency-driven argument, which says, you know, in an efficient society, we need to allocate resources to those who are most efficiently producing the social product. So when you're measuring inequality, you really are only concerned with, from a policy point of view, you're only concerned with the bad inequalities that are inequalities that are engendered by people who are not getting the appropriate efficient return on their efforts. And that's kind of related to this, because I've always felt that the equality of opportunity guys have got it right in this sense, because what they are doing is to just concern themselves with differences that are, if you like, inappropriate, that are unjust, rather than differences that are just. So within a particular sort of outcome distribution, people are with common effort, if you like, should have similar outcome distributions. And that's what you're really concerned about. So in distinguishing between those sort of inequalities that are necessary from an efficiency point of view, from inequalities that are unnecessary and inappropriate, the equal opportunity guys have really solved the sort of problem I'm trying to think about, which is efficiency based. It goes to Paolo's point. I mean, that's really what we would want to do. I've always been concerned with the obsession with income inequality, period. You know, because income inequality is made up of two sorts of inequality. Some that are appropriate and some that are inappropriate.
I have sometimes called those the cholesterol hypothesis, the good and bad cholesterol, the good and bad inequalities.
Yeah.
So Gordon, unfortunately, on this online environment, we have to end things on time because we have various people that have to go and do other things. Had we been here in presence, we would now take you out for a nice lunch and continue the conversation.
In my dreams, I wish I could be there, actually. I was really looking forward to coming to England for all sorts of reasons. And
we'll do it again when we can all travel and we'll have you over. But for now, thanks very much. I had other questions. We don't have time for those. I'll just mention to you, just for your own thinking and empirically, you know, you use age as experience. And if you had a better measure of experience, I wonder how the women would do on that. And that joint, the joint distribution might be quite different because of different gaps.
That's interesting. I was hoping to get some sort of longevity of appointment.
Yeah.
Variable.
Yeah.
Which
tenure.
But that just doesn't exist in the data sets that I'm looking at.
Anyway, thanks so much again. Thanks for, I think it's a bit early for you probably. And so—
I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, my time.
Yeah, so thanks for that. That's a big effort. Speaking of effort, many people are typing in the chat, thanks and applauses.
Appreciate that. I'll look at the chats. If anybody's got questions, drop me an email and I'd be happy to respond. That'd be fine.
Great. Thank you so much, Gordon. Yeah,
thanks a lot. You take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Bye-bye.
Bye.